From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Episode 10. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. Today's stories demonstrate the theme of sharing a family meal. Some meals are heartwarming, others are not. We welcome back our guest reader, Cheryl Rice. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
In Praise of Dinner Table Silence by Shirley Jackson. A long time ago, back in those unbelievable days when I used to buy half a pound of hamburger or four pork chops for dinner, and the living room furniture was new, and I still had 8 cups and 8 dinner plates that matched. Back in those days, if they ever did exist, my husband and I used to sit at the dinner table every night and talk to each other. I can't remember what we talked about, but I do know that we could hear each other. That was back in the time, too, when we had all sorts of ideas about bringing up children. We supposed that our children were not going to be messy all the time like other children we saw, and if we had a daughter, we assured each other, she was going to learn to like housework and sewing and cooking instead of being a drone around the house. And our children, we told each other happily, were going to have an intelligent share in family activities, such as sitting at the dinner table and joining in the conversation. We had a lot of those ideas. I still can't figure out what happened. It was going to be so wonderful, all of us sitting there lingering over coffee and hot chocolate, discussing the ballet and the good books we'd all been reading. Perhaps occasionally something would come up in school that the children would care to examine a little bit more searchingly. Perhaps an incident from the day would provoke a thoughtful argument. If the phone should ring, I don't know why we assumed that the chances of the phones ringing during dinner were remote. Perhaps it was because none of the people we knew called at that hour. A child would excuse himself gracefully and tell whoever was calling that we were dining. Compliments would be made on the food. An indulgent smile might pass between the parents at some childish quip. As I say, I still can't figure out what happened. All I know is that somehow things haven't turned out quite the way we expected. Take that notion about lingering over hot chocolate. What we didn't know then was that the older the child, the less time spent at the dinner table. A very small child, dawdling and playing and telling endless, giggling stories, can string out one French fried potato until he's permitted, with some shrillness and a certain involuntary clenching of fists, to be excused from the rest of his dinner. A 15-year-old boy, however, can put away 2 lamb chops, a baked potato, a lettuce and tomato salad, 3 slices of bread and butter, and a quart of milk before his father has quite finished asking for the salt, please. Before the rest of the family has had time to compliment the cook, string beans again? The 15-year-old is well on his way to the front door, jacket over one shoulder and a slab of blueberry pie in hand. If called back, he will perch unhappily on the edge of his chair, make a few perfunctory stabs at conversation, such as asking his younger sister kindly to be quiet for just 1 minute so other people can get a word in edgewise. He will also ask repeatedly if he can please be excused now because he is really in a terrible hurry, and will answer all questions with, "What?" He is in such a hurry, of course, because he has to get down to the soda shop and idle for 2 hours over a Coke. The only good book that seems to be discussed at our dinner table is the checkbook, usually introduced in some literary phrase as, "I gotta have a new..." Conversation, which is rarely initiated by the parents, is incessant, opinionated, and personal. It is the obligation of the parents to recognize, without hesitation, the Jerrys and the Lindas, the Davises, and the old lady Winchesters, whose names wander so freely through the social conversation. A maternal question such as, "Who is Tommy? Is he that sloppy little boy who borrowed all your records?" is regarded as out of bounds, partly because the parent is supposed to know who Tommy is, and partly because Tommy is the rage of the seventh grade, and he looks that way on purpose. Equally, Old Lady Winchester has been teaching the fourth grade for 43 years, and any parent who cannot recognize her by now is hopelessly out of it. Scientific discussions, seized upon by the father of the family in the hope of getting into the general conversation, can cause considerable chaos, with the father demonstrating the force of gravity with his butter knife, or explaining what makes airplanes go, while on either side, low-voiced conversations continue on topics such as whether Jimmy Smith is really the biggest drip in town, or what is playing at the movies, or who gets first rights at the television set at 8:30. Incidentally, a father leaving the table to get an atlas to show someone where Alaska is can count on losing his audience before he gets back. If the father has devoted considerable effort to telling how a camera takes pictures or how we get water out of a faucet, and a child remarks that that was not at all the way Mr. Williams told it in science class, the father would be advised to get out of the conversation at once and stay out. As for the small daily incidents that spur conversation, there are certainly plenty of them. Opening gambits on these may vary from such provocative questions as, "Guess why Jerry got kicked out of study hall again today?" to, "You know that three-legged dog that Johnson's got? Well, he's got four legs now." He never was three-legged. This was a canard spread by Harry Johnson. All that happened was the dog got one leg cut chasing the Martin's cat up a tree. So he used to limp. Now he doesn't. A parental attempt to introduce some small daily incident, "Who left the marbles lying on the stairs?" is usually sensibly disregarded. The phone always rings during dinner. Conversation about the food, although, of course, not on a gourmet level, is constant. There is surprise expressed at a new dish. "You mean I gotta eat this?" Personal preference indicated. "I hate liver. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it." And suggestions registered for improvement. "There's too much salt in this soup, and I got a black speck on my lettuce." Occasionally, a dish will provoke universal enthusiasm. "Say, this isn't bad at all." Or comparison with other cooks. "Mrs. Nash doesn't make stew like this, but she's a real good cook." The mother of the family naturally receives these comments graciously. "Then why don't you go eat at the Smiths if the food's so good?" And takes preferences into consideration in her menu planning, as in telling the father after dinner that he's going to go right on getting hamburger once a week unless something is done about the housekeeping budget. No, I can't really remember what it used to be like when we sat at the table and just talked. As I say, all I can really remember about it is that we could hear each other.
Our Daily Bread by Max Brand. Mrs. Sidney M. Lester used to come into the grocery store of Kahn and Seidelman every day in the busy time about 5:30. She looked things over, from the boxes of red apples to the rich hams and golden brown chickens under the glass of the delicatessen counter. Those bologna sausages, broadly sliced across, those glittering heaps of potato salad, overstrewn with parsley, and the various new touches which came into the store from the kitchen of Minnie Seidelman. Sometimes, but that was in the early days before Kahn and Seidelman understood, one of them asked Mrs. Lester if she was being served. On those occasions, she priced some of the delicacies and learned with undying interest over and over again that the little tubes of anchovy paste were 65 cents and that the dabs of pâté cost 75, and $3.50 for one tiny little jar of caviar always caused Mrs. Sidney M. Lester to nod her head and look out of the corner of a speculative eye as though she were telling herself that she must remember this when she gave her party next week. But the party never came, and in 6 months of constant patronage, Mrs. Lester never bought 5 cents worth of provisions of any kind from the store of Kahn and Seidelman. But every day, at about 5:30, she stole a loaf of bread and walked with dignity into the street. It would not be easy for most women to steal a loaf of bread. A loaf is about the clumsiest object in the world to conceal. But Mrs. Sidney M. Lester wore a short cloak of black silk, and when she picked up the loaf, she held it between her hip and the pinch of her left elbow so that it was always very well concealed by the cloak. These loaves, you understand, were not the ordinary blocks, soft, pulpy, cellophane-wrapped articles which you get in most stores. Instead, they were long, brown-crusted French loaves which come out of the oven of Minnie Seidelman's own kitchen. If you know what good bread is, go over there to Lexington Avenue this very day and buy a loaf of Minnie Seidelman's bread. It has a good smack to it, I can tell you. With a bottle of milk and an apple, it will make you a fine meal. And every day, at about 5:30, when the store was filled with shopping women who had finished their day's work and were getting food for supper, Mrs. Sidney M. Lester stole a loaf of that beautiful bread and took it away. Bernie Kahn saw it first of all. Bernie is a good boy. He is in high school now, when a lot of youngsters begin to put on airs. But Bernie has no nonsense about him, and when he comes home from school, he rushes through with his homework and then hurries over to help at the store during the rush hour. His cousin, Abe Seidelman, is following that good example, shamed into it. And of course, Ruth Kahn and sweet little Rose Seidelman are always around to help out. It's a wonderful thing, the way the Kahns and Seidelmans work together, and in their own families find all the help that they need for everything. By the way, Rose Seidelman is the pretty one with the high color. If you say that the apples are not as red as her cheeks, she lifts up a quick hand and touches one of them and looks as surprised as though she never had heard this remark in her life before. But to go back to Bernie, he was the one who discovered the thefts. He was not one of those headlong young fools who shout out the first guess that comes into the head the first day he suspected. What did he do? The second day, he counted every loaf in the stack just before Mrs. Sidney M. Lester went out past the bread counter. And then he counted them again after she went by and found out, as he suspected, that the store was one loaf shy. Any other boy would have talked then and there. But Bernie is really a boy in a thousand. He waited until the next day and the next day's theft, and then he trailed Mrs. Sidney M. Lester around the corner to the old place which had been turned into a rooming house. When she went in, he looked at the names under the mailboxes and discovered that she lived on the west side of the top floor. When Bernie was thoroughly equipped with this information, he went back to the store, took his father aside, and told him the news. The brow of his father darkened, but he said nothing. Bernie did not talk about it to the others. He watched his father and kept his mouth shut. You never saw a boy like Bernie. Nothing can keep him from getting on in the world. His father, Jake Kahn, is unlike the physical tradition of his family. Martha has cooked for her entire family with wonderful success all the days of her married life, but she can't put a pound on Jake. He remains as thin as a thinker, and his shoulders bend forward over a narrowing chest. That night after supper, they all went in, as usual, to sit for a half hour with Grandfather Oscar Kahn in the front room. Grandfather Oscar sits there in a brown leather chair and smokes a long pipe that has a china bowl with a cap of silver filigree. It curves down out of the white beard of Oscar and rests comfortably upon the top fold of his stomach, as upon a shelf. The half hour almost had ended when Jake Kahn said, "Well, we've got one at last." Grandfather Oscar opened one eye and lifted the white shag of one eyebrow. "What have you got, my son?" he asked. "A shoplifter," said Jake quietly. The stir in the family circle was immense. Grandfather Oscar opened both eyes wide. Only Bernie, rich in knowledge, sat still and said nothing, but watched. He is that kind of boy. "An old scoundrel of a woman," said Jake, "who steals a loaf of bread from our store every day in her life." His indignation put fire in his sunken eyes. As for Grandfather Oscar, he sat back in his chair and the mouthpiece of his pipe slipped from his lips, and the pipe itself sank down to the second fold of his stomach, where it rested again, as upon a shelf. "Il mio gatto," said Grandfather Oscar. "There's a jail for such people," cried Martha Kahn. "Il mio gatto," said Grandfather Oscar. "I know that sly old thief. I know the very one," cried Ruth, inspired by afterthought. Only Bernie Kahn said nothing. He is really a remarkable boy. Then Grandfather Oscar groaned again, his voice like a rumbling of distant thunder. "Illig immer und let er Gott de Watte, a loaf of bread." The last four words were unexpected. They struck the rest of the family to a sudden silence. They were rich in surprising implications. They attacked the whole Kahn family of the younger generations as from the rear. Grandfather Oscar said, "Every day of her life to steal a loaf of bread." There was such an accent upon bread that a shudder ran through the listeners. After that, Oscar Kahn closed his eyes, lifted his pipe to the uppermost fold of his stomach, and restored the mouthpiece to his lips. His family stole quietly from the room. The next day, they were changed people. No one said anything to anybody else, and every one of the Kahns had the same idea. That very afternoon, Abe Seidelman came running to Jake Kahn shortly after 5:30 and cried out, "That old woman, the one in the black coat, she's a thief!" "Yeah," said Jake. He looked down upon Abe not from a superior height of inches, but from a superiority of mind and soul and time. "What did she steal?"
"She stole a loaf of bread," said Abe. "I saw her put it under her cloak, as slick as you please."
"She stole a loaf of bread. And so what?" asked Jake. Bewildering light dawned upon the brain of Abe. "Geez," he said, and laughed a little, embarrassed. "Yeah, sure," said Abe. And he laughed a little again, very softly. The Kahns and the Seidelmans have lived and worked together for so many years that their mutual understanding is remarkable. In a flash, they now knew what their attitude should be toward Mrs. Sidney M. Lester, and that attitude never faltered. When she came in, always wearing the same dress of black silk, upon which time she had shed a sort of dust, almost impalpable, with a collar of black lace concealing the indignities which the years had worked upon her throat, she was sure to get a cheerful greeting from the Kahns and the Seidelmans. Not too much. Not so much attention that she might become embarrassed, but just enough to warm the air with a touch of neighborliness. Her pleasure was always asked. She always had a chance to price the caviar or the sliced white chicken or the lobsters or the pâté. And at the moment when she started from the store again, all the Kahns and all the Seidelmans were suddenly very busy with their faces turned to the rear of the store. At that moment, even a flash of lightning would not have been seen by these good people. As I was saying, this went on for upward of 6 months before Mrs. Sidney M. Lester failed to appear at the store. Her absence was noted at once. It was the subject of a telephone conversation between the House of Kahn and the House of Seidelman that evening. On the second day, again she was missing. And when the third evening did not bring her between 5 and 5:30, Bernie went around to the rooming house and rang the porter's bell. A sour old woman said, "Mrs. Lester must be in because she ain't gone out." "She's sick, I guess," said Bernie when he came back to the store. The Kahns and the Seidelmans were confused and worried by the thought. Then Jake Kahn did something about it. Jake is a dry, hard-faced man, and he is apt to surprise his entire family by the unexpected workings of his brain. They were about to close the store. The last clients were gone, and Jake's loud, dry voice said, "Ruthie, get a jar of that caviar out of the icebox and a couple of tubes of anchovy paste, and some of them anchovies, and a jar of pâté. Bernie, get a dozen of those Southern California navels. Select. No, maybe you better make it half a dozen. Some of those Spanish olives. Abe," he went on with additional selections. The unanimity of the Kahns and Seidelmans never was shown to better advantage. The mind of Jake instantly was apparent to all the rest, and in 10 minutes, every Kahn and Seidelman in the store was walking around the corner on that cold November day. For it was nearly Thanksgiving, and there was ice in every breath they drew. And every Kahn and every Seidelman of the lot carried something in hand to the little rooming house where Mrs. Sidney M. Lester lived. The sour-faced woman opened the door again. "Top floor, West," she said, "and help yourself." She stood at the bottom of the stairs, sniffing, as the procession climbed. When they came to the top floor, West, Jake tapped. There was no response. The smiles died upon the faces of the Kahns and the Seidelmans. Then Jake tried the door. It opened at once. He peeked, and the Kahns and the Seidelmans peeked behind him. They saw a neat little living room with a round table in the center of it. And the center of the table was crossed by an embroidered runner. And on the runner stood four or five books, upheld by bronze bookends. And on the wall there was a picture of a dignified gentleman in tails, making a gesture as though he were in the midst of a public address. They knew instantly that that was Sidney M. Lester, and that he was dead. "Good," said Jake, seeing that the inner door to the bedroom kitchenette was closed. "We'll get everything on the table and surprise her." They got into the living room. Their eyes gave warning to one another to make no sound. When Ruthie dropped a spoon out of the potato salad and it clattered to the floor, the whole group looked upon her as upon a mortal sinner, and she was frozen with fright. But presently they had everything laid out so that it would have done you good to see the caviar packed in glistening ice, and the silver white of pure chicken breasts sliced by Abe. "He really has a perfect touch for carving," Grandfather Oscar says. And there were grapes frosted with cold and sweetness, and the fragrant big California oranges, richer than the fabled apples of the Hesperides, and so on, through item after item, almost every article that Mrs. Sidney M. Lester had ever priced in the store was represented by that array upon the table. Then Jake, after taking a final survey of the table, advanced toward the inner door. The Kahns and Seidelmans, unbidden, ranged themselves in a straight line, beginning with Martha Kahn and ending with Bernie, who is the smallest of the family, though of course he more than makes up for inches with brains. Jake rapped delicately upon the inner door. He waited. He rapped again. Suddenly he rapped very loudly indeed. Martha Kahn caught her breath. Martha said, whispering, "Gott menuz." And then Jake turned the knob slowly and slowly pushed the door open. He and all the families behind him could look through the door to the chair where Mrs. Sidney M. Lester sat beside the western window with a time-yellowed old letter in her hand and her head bent thoughtfully to the side, and her eyes looking askance out the window for all the world as though she had just been pricing the caviar or the pâté in the store of Kahn and Seidelman. Jake Kahn did not speak. He turned slowly, and slowly he closed the door. He crossed the room. He opened the door into the hall. Through it filed the Kahns and the Seidelmans, stepping soundlessly. So perfectly were they of one mind that it did not occur to any of them to take even the perishable caviar away, but all remained as they had brought it and arranged. What was to have been a feast but became a sacrifice. The caviar with its glistening ice, the rich pâté, the snow-white slices of chicken which Abe had carved, all stood there in order. And the California oranges, at $1.25 a dozen, gave into the air an aromatic fragrance purer than the purest incense in a church. The Kahns and Seidelmans went noiselessly down the stairs with big Martha Kahn weeping silently all the way, and Jake comforting her, for he understood the nature of their loss.
you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Our director and editor is Josh Jers, our producer and host is Margie Colewalker, and our stories today were narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.